Brethren, the title of this message will become evident about halfway through, but I want you to know in advance where we're going. And so the title is taken from 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 2. The title is, Now is the Day of Salvation. And so I put that there because it's a very important topic that we look at. And when Paul wrote this book, he intended to convey a very important message to the members there. Paul was in Ephesus on his third missionary journey when he wrote 1 Corinthians in the spring of the year, likely 55 AD. And that book addressed matters of conduct within the congregation. We covered that last month. And a few months later, in the same year, Paul had traveled on from Asia Minor, where Ephesus is, it's modern-day Turkey area, traveled to Macedonia, or to the European continent. And it was there, while he was in Macedonia, that news reached him of some trouble that had come into Corinth and to the surrounding areas as well. There were some agitators, some pretending to be apostles, and they had come in among the members and were causing some great harm to the congregations in Achaia. Now, Achaia is that region of Greece south of Macedonia, and it covers where Corinth is, but many of the other towns and cities there in that region too. It's really good that we pick up a story flow, and in Paul's writings, we see something here. I want to show you the story flow because it connects with the reason for him writing this book as he did, and to the people that he did. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, in verse 2, no, 2 Corinthians, excuse me, that's where we are this month. It's 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 2. He says, Grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. This letter was written to the church of God at Corinth. We see this in verse 1, to the church of God which is at Corinth, with all the saints who are in all Achaia. So in Achaia, again, it encompassed that whole region. If you look on your map, many of you have a map in the back of your Bible, you'll see Corinth is on a little isthmus, and then below it there's another section of land, and there are many different towns and even some congregations down in those areas. And so it was written to the church of God that covered that big, vast area. It wasn't just in Corinth. It was soon after the time when Paul and others had been exposed to great danger while they had been in Ephesus. And this account is found in Acts chapter 19. What I'm going to do in the early part of the sermon here is kind of give you a travelogue of where these things that happened, because it ties some things together when we see them later on. In Acts chapter 19, beginning in verse 18, we see a story here. We'll just scan through part of it. There was there were miracles that were being done by Paul and others who were preaching. We begin seeing this develop in verse 11 and onward, and we pick it up in verse 18. And many who had believed, when they saw what Paul and those others who were with him were doing and preaching, and many who believed came confessing and telling their deeds, and also many of those who had practiced magic brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted up the value of them, and it totaled 50,000 pieces of silver. So quite a valuable amount of treasure, if you will, was just burned there, these books of magic and other things. And people had come to realize that those were not the things that they should live by. In verse 20, so the word of the Lord grew and grew mightily and prevailed. But there were others there, Demetrius and others who, Demetrius was a silversmith, obviously a part of a guild, and they, as part of that business group, they knew other people who made their living in that area, actually making idols and selling them, and probably selling to the many different tourists who came through, and the ones who came on pilgrimages to worship at the pagan temples there. And so they were causing a very great deal of difficulty for Paul, which he mentioned in 2 Corinthians. When Paul left Ephesus, he went to Troas and then on to Macedonia. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, we see that his travels are being followed here. Furthermore, when I came to Troas, which is on the northwest shore of what would now be Turkey, and that's where he stood that time and heard that Macedonian call from God was leading him to go across into Europe. He's there again on this visit. When I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel and a door was opened to me by the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit because I did not find Titus, my brother. But taking my leave of them, I departed for Macedonia. And so Paul was looking for Titus, but could not find him in that city and traveled onward. And he was in Macedonia when he wrote this letter of 2 Corinthians. You look on chapter 7 and verse 5 through 7. For indeed, when we came to Macedonia, our flesh had no rest. Paul is talking here of the difficulties that he and others who were with him went through as they were traveling and serving God's people in many different areas. But we were troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears. Nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus. I'm going to really focus on what Paul is saying there. When we get to the first big point I want to make after I set the stage with his travels a little bit. See what God was doing. And Paul was there working hard to serve God's people, looking for Titus to serve with him and to help in this great work that was being done. It would be as if one of us were traveling by foot or by boat from here to Montana or farther away to help, and you go and you want to find the guy who's there and be with him and work together. But sometimes it just didn't work out. In verse 7, and not only by his coming, he was not only comforted by Titus coming to him, but also by the consolation, with the comforting with which he was comforted in you. There is a connection here between God's people. And Paul, who was under duress on this travel, wondering how is Titus doing? Titus was going to be bringing news to him of Corinth, to whom he had just recently written that first epistle. And so we see this emotion among God's people and this desire to help. And then you see when the good news comes, they are comforted by God and comforted by one another, just hearing of the good news. And so we can see that kind of connection. In verse 8, it says, for even if I made you sorry with my letter, it's referring back to what he had to write to them in 1 Corinthians. He says, I do not regret it, though I did regret it. I perceive that the same epistle made you sorry, though only for a while. Because Titus had brought in news that they had responded so very well. They were doing well. They had made such progress in their spiritual life and overcoming the things that Paul had written to them about in 1 Corinthians. And that's why Paul was comforted and encouraged. And he could see God's hand in their lives and working there with them. In chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, he says, now concerning the ministering to the saints, there was something that had begun and now was finding its concluding days here in this book as well. It began in 1 Corinthians, but also mentioned in the book of Acts. Look what he says about this. And what I'm pointing out here is the interaction between different congregations of God's people. They're not just autonomous congregations. Paul was serving people who were connected together, though they lived many miles apart. And so we see this, verse 1 of chapter 9, now concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you, for I know your willingness, that which I boast of you to the Macedonians. So there he was in Macedonia. He's writing this book to them, and he's boasting of them, how good they are doing, how well, how generous. Their reputation is being brought forward in a very, very positive way, that Achaia was ready a year ago. And that's where this book is written to, Achaia, to Corinth, and to the other towns around it. And your zeal has stirred up the majority. You can see that Paul was so appreciative of their response to this need to help other people that they didn't even know, but they knew they were part of God's church, and they were very willing, as many others as well, to help them. And it must have been quite an effort, because it spans many different cities to bring collection of goods and resources, money, together to help God's people in Jerusalem, who were having a very, very difficult time. You can see, just put that with Acts 20, verse 1 and 2. And again, because we see these referred to in different books of the Bible, I just wanted to really anchor this, that there is a dynamic connection going on, and it lasted for years among the different congregations. In Acts 20, verse 1 and 2, and after the uproar had ceased, Paul called the disciples to him, embraced them, and departed to go to Macedonia. This is when he was on his way after writing 1 Corinthians. Now he's expressing this desire then to go on. And when he had gone over that region and encouraged them with many words, he came to Greece, which is where Corinth is. On his journey continued. You could follow this on his third missionary journey, which is sometimes detailed in different maps that are available. And so along the way, when Paul is out, hundreds of miles from the people that he knew, he was still thinking of them. He was in contact with the church in Corinth throughout that entire time, and for other congregations as well. And that collection that was mentioned in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9, it's the same one that was referenced in 1 Corinthians that we spoke of last month. And the results of that collection are mentioned in Romans. Now, see, Paul is, again, writing to all these congregations, but he's their pastor. He's the one who is connecting them with each other, and others are coming and going, serving with him, and bringing messages. And so we see the results of that in Romans 15, verse 25 and 26. But now I am going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints, for it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are in Jerusalem. And just, again, just to anchor this, this is like if we were helping people in Utah, and we here in Tacoma, in Olympia, we're helping with Seattle and Portland and Salem, and we're pulling resources together to send the needed gift, the needed assistance to members in Utah. It's a big geographical thing as well, but I really want to let us know to see this throughout these different books, that God's church is one church, that God's people are one people, that God's faith is given to us as the same faith for all, that God's word is true for all of us. It's good to notice the interaction among these many different congregations in the Church of God. They were part of a larger body. It's so important, brethren, for us to realize that us today, we all are part of a larger body too. It's not just individual congregations, not autonomous groups of believers in various cities. We need the same kind of connection that they had among them. There was structure and connection among the churches. The same ministry served them all, traveling many miles and many months at a time to serve them under all kinds of difficult circumstances. The same truth was taught to all of them, the same doctrines, the same faith, the same hope and love and promises. But they weren't always in unity on these spiritual truths and structure. And that's why Paul was inspired to write the second epistle to them. There was a great deal of unsettling agitation in the church at Corinth and in the other cities and towns in that part of Greece. And Paul had written some of this in 1 Corinthians and addressed it further in the second letter. 2 Corinthians is a book that Paul wrote to and about two different groups of people who were in the church. Some really were in the church, and some only appeared to be in the church. But Paul wrote to both groups directly. He wrote about both groups directly as well. He wrote about some who were the obedient and faithful members of the church, and he wrote to and about some who were referred to as false apostles, who were causing the harm and disunity within the church. See, 1 Corinthians was more about the conduct within the church, and now 2 Corinthians is more about the deception that had come in among them, brought in by others, and Paul deals with that. Are there lessons relevant for us today? Yes, there are. Are there ever such problems in the Church of God in our day as they faced in Corinth at that time? Well, brethren, in this introductory message about 2 Corinthians, I want us to notice how Paul strengthened the faithful members and warned those who had come to cause harm to them. In point one, after a long introduction, I want to focus on the faithful members, because this is where Paul started his book when he wrote to them his letter. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3, we see this. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort. He's directing them toward God, who gives us that comfort. That comfort is consolation, to console someone who is grieving or hurting. We extend our consolation when someone is grieving the death of a family member, for instance, in other ways too. And encouragement. So Paul starts out his address to them by saying, it's God who gives us the comforting, the mercy, and the encouragement we need. Verse 4, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. And so we notice this. And just as it was for them, the same is true for us, that our comforting comes from God, and especially comes in our time of suffering. And Paul knew that, experienced it. He speaks of it here, and I want to cover some of those things. I want us to see in this first point, I want to follow this thread through his book and see this comforting that God gives and how he gives it. Because this is what strengthened the Corinthian church, and this is where he found the evidence of their spiritual growth and praised them for it. We see that over and over in this book. And what a great way to begin this letter. Since Paul began this way, I want to focus in that direction first. And so we're going to skip over some of the problems as we look first through the book and see this thread of the comforting that comes from God. To me, this helped me to understand, as I read this book of 2 Corinthians, to begin to understand it in a way that helps me to gain and grow in my understanding. And for verse 5, for as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our comforting also abounds through Christ. He gives us the consolation, even as we suffer. And I could just stop and ask and say, would each one of you raise your hand and tell us one way in which you have suffered and yet you've seen and felt the comforting of God? We would all have days of stories we could tell. And what a great thing to realize that. And Paul is drawing the attention of the people in Corinth to that, that they are blessed so very much by God. In verse 6, now if we are afflicted, and Paul was often afflicted, it is for your consolation. He says, I'm willing to suffer. I'm willing to go through these things because it will help you. It will console you. It will comfort you. And it's for your consolation and salvation, which is effective for enduring the same sufferings which we also suffer. What great thought this is. That when we learn through our sufferings that God is there with us and for us, that we can help others to go through their times of suffering. Or if we are comforted, it's for your consolation and salvation. When we have been comforted, then we're able to help someone else. And there's always someone else who needs that kind of help from their friends. It's God who comforts us by His Spirit, through His Word, and by others whom He has comforted. We see that. We are able to share that comforting. That's part of the message of this book. Paul experienced that, and he experienced it from Titus, but also from those people in Corinth who had responded so very well. It gave great comfort to Paul. We'll see that as we go. In Isaiah 51, and I'll read it for you in verse 12, speaking of a prophecy of the Messiah, it says, I, even I, am he who comforts you. And who are you that you should be afraid of a man who will die, or the Son of Man who will be made like grass? The Lord comforts us. That's a lesson that's consistent through the Bible. And Paul is bringing that to the people at Corinth. In verse 7 it says, and our hope for you is steadfast, because we know that as you are partakers of the suffering, so also you will partake of the consolation. And there are times when we go through those kind of troubles. There are times when one of us is having a very difficult time, and we can all rally around that person and say, our hope for you is steadfast. You can make it through this. You will make it through this. You will be able to be blessed, and then you'll be able to share in that consolation. In verse 24, he says, not that we have dominion over your faith. He's talking about being their pastor, and there's things that he had to do to make sure that things were done, as we talked of last time about being done decently and in order. It's not that he was having dominion over their faith, but are fellow workers for your joy, for by faith you stand. In the NIV it says, not that we lord it over your faith, but we work with you for your joy, because it is by faith that you stand. And so his point here is not being corrective, he's encouraging. That's the message that we see in this book, to encourage them, to give them joy, even in the difficult times, to be able to be joyful, because that increases their faith and they stand by faith. And he was so pleased with them. I will say the word proud of them because of how well they had responded to his first letter that he wrote. His desire was not to cause them to sorrow, but to promote their joy, to strengthen their faith so that they could continue living their lives with the joy that Christ gives to them. How did Paul view them, the people he served in Corinth? Look in chapter 3 and verse 2. He said of them, you are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read by all As Christians, they have been transformed in their hearts and minds, and in their conduct and in their words. They were different than they had been before, and now their examples were evident, so that it was noticeable to other people. Verse 3, you are manifestly an epistle of Christ. It's there for all to see, he says, that you have responded to the calling that God has given you, and you are an epistle of Jesus Christ with his words, his law written in your hearts and on your mind. Ministered by us, he says, written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God. This is high praise that Paul is expressing here toward the people in Corinth. Not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh, on the human heart, on the spirit that God gives to us. That is of the heart. Beautiful words of encouragement. In verse 6, he says, who has made us, speaking of God, God who has made us sufficient as ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. That's what was written on their heart, was the new covenant. That's what was now being so evidently expressed in their words, in their conduct toward others. It was manifestly an epistle of Christ, that they were living with those terms of the new covenant. Just as it said in Jeremiah 31 and verse 33, again, I'll quote that for you. But this is the covenant that I will make. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Paul is saying to the Corinthians, there you are, the people of God, with his words, the new covenant written there in your heart. There's a really great doctrinal section here in this book, which we'll save for another time, in chapters 4, 5, and 6. There's some many really important things to consider there. There's a right way to live in the sight of God. In chapter 4 and verse 4, I'll show you this one because it'll come up later toward the end of our sermon. In verse 3 of chapter 4, but even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. There's a lot of doctrinal points in these sections that are to be understood as well. So Paul spoke to them of the encouragement, the comforting. He gets into the doctrinal sections there as well. In chapter 6, continuing with this theme, and I want to follow it right through the book, how he addressed them straight through this book, how Paul thought of them and was appreciative of all that they were able to do. In 2 Corinthians 6, verse 1 and 2, it says, we then as workers together with him, with the Lord, with God, also plead with you not to receive the grace of God in vain. For he says, in an acceptable time I have heard you, and in the day of salvation I have helped you. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. That's why I picked this title. He gets halfway through the book and he makes this main point. Brethren, now is our day of salvation. Now, with God's Spirit in us, now with the new covenant written in our hearts, now is the day of salvation. And it just elevates it to an understanding to help us to realize that indeed this book is about our own salvation. I want to make a little transition point here as we continue in chapter 7. I said that there are two different groups of people he's writing to and about. There are the faithful ones and the unfaithful ones. They're believers and unbelievers. This in chapter 7 and verse 2 is a transition. There are several others in the book too. But you'll see this as we, I want to do it in passing so that we can make this connection. It says in verse 2, open your hearts to us. We have wronged no one. We have corrupted no one. We have defrauded no one. Now, he's not saying this in a corrective way. Paul had been accused by these who had come in. We'll see this in just a few minutes. Paul had been accused of being corrupt. And he's saying to the people, look, here's, you see the example of how we've served. Open your hearts. We have not wronged you, as others said he had. We have corrupted no one. We have defrauded no one. There's a pretty strong indication that this collection that was being made in all these different areas that Paul was defrauding people by using it for his own purposes. And that's why he so carefully addressed how it was gathered and who went with him and how it was accounted for as that progressed. This implies that there were some who accused him of being these things, of exploiting them for his own gain. The things that the false apostles, of those who supported them, did and said, caused harm to the whole congregation. Yeah, there's a lot of this in the book too, but the main point is to the faithful people, there's praise. When he's speaking this way, he's speaking of the others, and he addresses them very clearly as we get toward the end of the book. And that's why it's important for Paul to defend his integrity and remind them of his careful approach towards serving them, and to realize that it was actually the false people, the false apostles, who were guilty of what they claimed he was doing. In chapter 7, verse 4, returning back to the faithful members of the church, we see this. Great is my boldness of speech toward you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I am exceedingly joyful in all our tribulation. He said, because you're responding so well. He was joyful even to go through all the things that happened to him. He says in verse 5, for indeed when we came to Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears, and you can follow through other books and you can see what he was going through at those times. Nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast. See, this thread, it holds solid all the way through this book. God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus. And he had not been able to find Titus before when he was in Troas, and now he's in Macedonia, and Titus comes to him, finds him. Put yourself in a situation like that. You're traveling in a time period where you don't have cell phones, you can't really connect. How do two people find themselves in a big city, and yet they did? You know, I'm sure there's a lot behind the scenes that is not recorded here. Look for me here. Find me there. At this place. Look. Ask around. The people there will know if I've been there. In some way, God led them together. And Paul was so comforted by the coming of Titus because of the news that he brought. Look in verse 7. And not only by his coming, but also by the consolation, by the comforting with which he was comforted in you when he told us of your earnest desire, your mourning, your zeal for me, for his cause, so that I rejoiced even more. The report that Titus brought was so positive, so good, and it just lifted Paul's spirits. It helped him to be able to write this book. And this is the kind of interaction that builds faith and strength and helps congregations and helps the whole church to be strengthened by what was happening here, God's Spirit moving in and among his people. And that first book he wrote had the desired and best effect of their repentance and their zeal now for this positive forward momentum that they had. In verse 8, it says, "For even if I made you sorry with my letter, I do not regret it." We covered a bit of this in the introduction, but I wanted to see it here in the context of what he was doing. We can see how encouraging this was to Paul in verse 13. "Therefore, we have been comforted in your comfort, that God was with them and comforted them. Titus came and told them how well they had done," and that was so encouraging to Paul. "That we rejoiced exceedingly more for the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by you all." You imagine that meeting. It's written up in these terms, but that day, that evening, whenever it was, when Titus and Paul came together and shared this news, it was probably a very special time together. Some really good things were said and done. You can imagine the hugs, the cheering, the prayers, the thankfulness for God's people having made it through such a difficult time. The faithful church members in Corinth had responded so well to Paul's previous letter, and this strengthened and encouraged them all. Titus, Paul, and all of them. Just to summarize this first point, one of the main reasons and part of the success of this book of 2 Corinthians to the church there at Corinth in Achaia is the spiritual blessings of God's comforting of his people and the examples of how that strengthened all of them and helped them all to grow. It was in the receiving of these blessings that the faithful members in Corinth and Achaia were able to withstand the division and the heresy that false apostles had brought in. And this is a very good lesson for us today. You back up what we heard in the first message. We want to be able to withstand the winds of doctrine that blow. Be close to each other. Be faithful. Be helpful to one another. Encourage and comfort one another and provide that comforting to everyone who needs it through all their suffering. And point two, another reason Paul wrote this second letter to the church at Corinth was to warn a disobedient faction within the church. I purposely wanted to do the positive thing first because that's where Paul started. We go back through the book and we can sort through and we could find why he was talking about those things. Rather than read many different verses, what I'd like to do today is just read a summary of this part for you in this textbook that I like to use, The Life and Epistles of St. Paul. Because in the section about 2 Corinthians, this side of that whole topic is summarized, and we could look and find in this book all of the references that are here. But I just want to show you this because then you'll see more clearly why Paul was so encouraged by the positive things that God had done for his people and in their lives. And you see some of the difficult things. These are things that we would watch out for. If Paul were writing to us, oh yeah, he is. He did. This is what he would tell us to watch out for as well. And I'll just break in here on page 438, 439. "At length, the long-expected Titus arrived at Philippi and relieved the anxiety of his master by better tidings than he had hoped to hear. The majority of the Corinthian church had submitted to the injunctions of St. Paul and testified the deepest repentance for the sins into which they had fallen. But there were still a minority whose opposition seems to have been rather embittered than humbled by the submission which the great body of the church had thus yielded. They proclaimed in a louder and more contemptuous tone than ever their accusations against the apostle. They charged him with craft, in his design or deceit, and with selfish and mercenary motives. A charge which they probably maintained by insinuating that he was personally interested in the great collection which he was raising. On page 439, it continues, "Meanwhile, it was obvious how singularly inconsistent this accusation was in the mouths of those who eagerly maintained that Paul could be no true apostle because he did not demand support from the churches which he founded." So because of that, he was accused, that he didn't collect their tithes from them. The same opponents accused him likewise of egregious vanity and of cowardly weakness. They declared that he was continually threatening without striking and promising without performing, always on his way to Corinth, but never venturing to come, and that he was as vacillating in his teachings as he was in his practice, refusing circumcision to Titus, yet circumcising Timothy, a Jew among the Jews and a Gentile among the Gentiles. You see how these things just rippled through. And Paul addresses them all in this book and others too, but especially in this one. From the notices of them given by St. Paul himself, it seems certain that they were Judaizers. I'm going to turn to a couple scriptures here to see this. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 22, because he does directly address these people and warns of them. 2 Corinthians 11, 22, it says, "Are they Hebrews? There were those who came in and apparently were claiming that they had this pedigree. They were Hebrews." He says, "So am I." "Are they Israelites?" "So am I." "Are they seed of Abraham?" "So am I." And so we can see from references like this that these who come among them were very, very likely Judaizers trying to get God's people to turn back from the fullness of understanding of the new covenant, to return back to older ways. It says, "It also appears that they were headed by an emissary from Palestine." You can see that in chapter 11 and verse 4. Just turn there and see. "For if he who comes preaches another Jesus," there's someone who had come among them. Paul is referencing here that person whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. See, these are things that were brought in among them from other people, or who had brought letters of commendation from some members of the church. And that would be noted in 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 1. You see, I'm just showing you here that Paul, he doesn't give them much oxygen to really ignite the flame of their heresies. He only refers to it in a passing sense to identify them and to put a mark on the things they were doing that people should be aware of, the discernment that they needed. In chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "Do we begin again to commend ourselves? Or do we need, as some others, epistles of commendation?" Do they need credentials to say, "Here I am, and here's my certificate of ordination"? Others had come in with letters as though the Corinthians should pay attention to this, because the ones who signed the letters said these are important people. And so Paul is addressing these kind of things. It helps to identify that there were those who in fact had come in this way. It says, "And boasted of his pure Hebrew descent," the other one, "and his especial connection with Christ himself." You can see that in chapter 11, verse 23. Paul calls him a false apostle, a minister of Satan, disguised as a minister of righteousness, and hints that he was actuated by corrupt motives. This is quite a good summary. And brethren, we could turn to all these different verses in this book and find the references here. I wanted to spend our time seeing the references to the positive things that God had done in his people. But we see that Paul was still addressing these kinds of things too. Now this is a good thing that we could study. They contrasted his confident bearing with the timidity and self-distrust which had been shown by Paul. They said that Paul was not a great speaker like this guy. And they even extolled his personal advantages over their first teacher, comparing his rhetoric with Paul's inartificial speech, his commanding appearance with the insignificance of Paul's bodily presence. So there were so many different things like that. I just want to reference a couple of things as we look then at how Paul addressed these people. In chapter 13, in verse 2, he says, "Now speaking to the faithful members," this is instruction to them. This is not correction for them. This is instruction on how to withstand the onslaught from the deceivers. Verse 2. "I have told you before and foretell as if I were present the second time. And now being absent, I write to those who have sinned before and to all the rest, that if I come, I will not spare." They questioned Paul's authority, and he says, "If I come, I will not spare." This letter was sent before he arrived. It would have been read there. I wonder if the people that he was mentioning actually waited for him to come, or if they simply just moved on. You know, when Paul was traveling around, he would go to Antioch, from there up to Troas, from there to Philippi. It was like people came in behind him. They knew it would be months before he would be back, or maybe years. And so as he traveled to preach God's truth, he was followed by those who would disrupt it. And this is something that just was there at the beginnings of this phase of God's work in church. It's there for us too. In chapter 13 and verse 10, he says, "Therefore I write these things." This is the reason he's writing to that faction, being absent, us being present, I should use sharpness, according to the authority which the Lord has given me for edification and not for destruction. He rather would spend his time with the faithful members for their edification, but they have to come in and find and sort out the others, it says, for destruction, for the protection of the rest. This, it says in Coney Barnhausen's book, this verse 10, is the last echo of the military allegory that he used earlier in the book about the spiritual warfare. He's just finishing that allegory here with that statement. If we will look at this book, brethren, as we see in verse 11 in chapter 13, how does Paul conclude this book? Written to the faithful members, praising them, encouraging them, being comforted by them. How does he finish this book? Verse 11, "Finally, brethren, farewell. Become complete. Be of good comfort." Started in verse 3 of chapter 1, God who comforts us. Telling us here as he closes this book, be of good comfort. Be of one mind, all unified in the faith, all doing what is right and true. Live in peace, not having those kinds of factions among us that would cause the disruption that he had to deal with. Live in peace, and the God of love and peace will be with you. What a great book this is. And I really like what it says in chapter 6, in verse 2. As we read this book to God's faithful people, It says, behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. Got a wonderful potluck